ahead and get started. I have a note up here that says the central projector is broken. Does it sound okay? All right. The central projector is broken for now. They say they're replacing it, but for now we're going to have to be on that one. So if you have trouble seeing this one, you want to move. So reminder of a few things. One is I'd like you to do a midterm class midterm survey, if you would. It's a useful thing and can actually lead to useful changes in how your workshops run or your labs run if you give them good feedback. Exam 2 is coming up a week from Thursday. Sort of amazing. So this will cover from where we started with friction in Newton's law, so friction and circular motion, to the start of momentum conservation, which basically will start in about 15 minutes or so. So it'll be right after the start of today's lecture. So it'll be to the end of what I'm saying about gravity, which will be at the start of this one. So it'll be chapters 5 through 8, excluding these sections, problem sets 5 and 6, and workshops 4 through 6. Okay, does anybody have any questions about that? About the exam. The drill will be the same, except it'll be here during class time on Thursday. A week from Thursday. Okay, so again, you can have one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. You can write anything you want on it. Further in the semester, I'll give you the other side. So, okay. So next week, I have to be out of town again, so there'll be no lecture here on Tuesday, but I'll post slides and audio, hopefully. Sometimes the audio files are a little hard to transfer from someplace where the internet's not so good. So this trip is a place I've never been, so I'm not certain. The internet, I hope, will be good. So if it is, that will be posted on schedule. If not, I'll try to figure something out. Okay. So last time we were talking about gravitation, and gravitation is the force that comes about if something has mass, basically. So if I have two masses, big M and little m, there is a force that Newton tells us is described by this equation, which goes as a constant times each of the masses divided by the distance between the center of the masses squared, assuming they have spherical symmetry, which of course we can draw here. We will shortly learn how to deal with a case that doesn't have spherical symmetry, but you can basically assume it's at the center of something that's symmetric, or it's at something called the center of mass, which we'll talk about later. But at any rate, if you assume they have spherical symmetry, that's the distance between the two centers of the masses. It is a vector, so it's along the line between the two things, and this minus sign says that it's always attractive. Okay, and the form of this is actually identical to what you're going to run into when you hit electricity next semester, and there are lots of similarities between the two. The difference being, in electricity, you have charge here, which can take either sign, so the combination of two charges can give you a plus sign or a minus sign here, which can make it repulsive or attractive. So with gravity, we have only one type of charge, if you will, and it's just mass, and when it comes to one positive sign. So it turns out that it's particularly powerful to think of the interaction of these two masses in the following way. You sort of imagine that a mass creates a condition in space around it, which we'll call a gravitational field. And if something is put into space where there is a gravitational field, it will feel a force per unit mass. So if I put a test mass there of mass m, there will be a force on it, which is given by the gravitational field times its mass. Okay? And so the way to think about this is, if you know the gravitational force and you just divide out the mass that you're placing around to sort of test what the force is on it, then you get the gravitational field. And in fact, you can visualize the gravitational field sort of going through that mental exercise. Let's suppose you want to know what the gravitational field looks like around this blue mass right there. Well, I can imagine taking a little test mass, and it doesn't matter what the size of it is, big M, little m, 10 kilograms, 100 kilograms, it doesn't matter because the gravitational field is the force per unit mass. So I divide out the mass of the test mass. That's why we do it, okay? Because what we're trying to do is to come up with a description of the space that doesn't depend on how you're measuring it. It doesn't depend on what mass you're putting to test it. It only depends on the mass that you have there initially that's creating this condition in space. So it may sound like a sort of needless complication. It turns out to be an extraordinarily powerful calculational concept, and it sort of frees you up from the complication of having to know everything about these two masses. And you can begin to talk about what happens in space where there is a gravitational field. And I can tell you the gravitational field looks like such and such. And I don't have to specify that I have some configuration of 30 masses over here that's producing it. So this it's a very freeing concept. We are literally pulling it out of thin air right now. You will see one of the reasons I'm talking about it isn't so much that we're going to do a ton with it in this class, but you will do an immense amount of stuff with the analog of it next semester, which is the electric field. So the way that we look at what happens in the space, the way we visualize this gravitational field, is I put the mass here, and now we take a test mass, and you can imagine I put the test mass at all these different points. And then we look at what is the force per unit mass on that test mass, and we draw a little symbol to characterize it. The symbol is an arrow that's in the direction of the gravitational force on that test mass. And it is of a magnitude, which is the gravitational force divided by that test mass. And so that means you're always pointing radially in, if you can imagine. If you're a little bit closer, this arrow, not really well drawn, is supposed to be longer because the force of gravity gets stronger as 1 over r squared. If you're further away, it's a little weaker. Okay, so you, in a sense, you could actually put multiple masses around and then actually visualize what the gravitational field looks like. So we are sort of pulling it out of thin air. It is sort of a calculational tool. One of the things that you'll find that is one of the most magical things, actually, I hope you'll get a sense of next semester, is that when you're looking at electric and magnetic fields, you do the same sort of trick. But at some point during the semester, you realize they sort of take on a life of their own. And you begin to ask yourself whether the field is not more real than the particles itself. So it turns out to be an extremely powerful concept that allows you to make a lot of progress. But we're not going to do much with that in gravity, but you'll see a lot of it next semester. At any rate, one of the other things that you'll see that's an analog between electricity and gravitation is the fact they're both vector fields, and calculating things with vector fields, as you've seen, can be rather painful because you have to take into account the direction as well as the magnitude. So it turns out that in some ways it's easier to think your way through the way that energy changes as you change the system. So, for example, suppose I have a big mass here, m, and let's suppose I have a little mass, little m, that's extremely far away, infinity, r infinity. Okay, so far away that there's effectively no force between these two particles. And then I bring that little mass m from infinity into a distance r from this big mass m. And we calculated last time that basically, you calculate how much work you do to bring this particle in, because there's a force, right? There's a force of gravity. And if you're going to bring this particle in, you're having to exert a force to do that. Now, it may seem a little strange, but if you're bringing about acceleration, you're actually exerting a force against the motion of the particle because you're having to hold it to keep it from collapsing, accelerating into the mass. And you're moving a distance, so there's an amount of work that you can then calculate. And we basically did that calculation last time, and what we found was the amount of work that you have to do to bring this mass in from infinity to this point R is equal to minus GMM over R. So this is work, or think of it as energy. So that's the amount of energy that the system has stored within it, the potential energy, which comes about because this mass is at a distance R away from the other mass. It may sound strange that it's negative, but if you think about it, if I have two masses like this, I have to do work to separate them, right? So if I'm bringing in from infinity, I have to sort of do negative work. So that basically means that, you know, the system is getting energy in it as it comes in from infinity. So that's what that negative sign is telling you. It tells you that it would take work to separate them out. It's exactly like you would have if you were removing an electron from an atom. Right? If you look at the ionization energy for hydrogen in the ground state, it is minus 13.6 eV. Right, it's negative, and that tells you the bound state. Means you have to do work of 13.6 eV, or 2, or whatever it is, 13.2, and remove it. Okay. So that form, if you, using that form, if we look at the change in the potential energy going from R1 to R2, for example, then it is really the difference. It's this final position minus the initial position of this change in the potential energy. And when you look at this, it isn't obviously like what you're used to for swing set problems and pendulum problems, because those are being done on the surface of the Earth. And we did do a derivation last class where I showed you that this form of the change in potential energy is basically the same thing. It's mgh if you're at the surface of the Earth, or the surface of the Moon if you adjust for what g is. Okay? So, if you're at the surface of the Earth and doing a projectile problem or a pendulum problem, use mgh. If you start looking at planets moving around each other and things like that, then you're really going to have to be using that form. Okay, so if we plot the form of this energy function as a function of distance from the mass, it goes as minus 1 over r, which is what we have here. So this is a graphical representation of how the energy of the system varies as you change r. And what it says is, if I take the two masses and I put them more closely together, then they are more deeply bound. That means I take more work to pull them out. So that's really what the negative sign means. It means I have to put work in the system to separate them. And a way to think about it is, if I have an object at a certain distance, R prime here, if I put this much energy into the system, it's enough for that object to actually be able to separate from the other mass. Or if you want to talk about it in terms of, space flight and stuff, that gives it enough energy that the object can attain the escape velocity, it can actually separate from the planet or whatever. So this is just like the ionization energy in chemistry that you're hopefully very used to, most of you. So to look at that a little more carefully, let's imagine that we give an object some energy, and just enough to throw it up in a parabola, right? So it comes back down, and let's say it goes up a bit of h. So that would be sort of half a. And that would basically mean we're starting at a radius of the Earth, okay? And we give it a certain kick, so it has enough energy, we give it a certain amount of energy, so it has enough energy to go up until R equals H. And at this point, it doesn't have enough to go any further, so it comes back down. For C and B, if we just worry, I mean, it's a conservative force, so it only depends on the endpoint, so it doesn't actually matter whether I take this path or that path. If I'm changing the radius, in these cases, they just keep going, okay? So what that means is I have to have at least this much energy to get to the escape velocity. I could have more, so they could be way up here and have a big kinetic energy. But what this means is that if you're going to have the limiting case where you just achieve escape from the Earth, for example, or whatever body you're trying to get away from, then we say that you have the escape velocity, so that's remember, velocity is a measure of kinetic energy, so it's the amount of energy you need to get away from the system. And the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv escape squared, has to then be equal to the potential energy of this bound state, which if you're on the surface of the Earth, this R is then the radius of the Earth, and the mass is the mass of the Earth. And so your equation would simplify to this, where that's m sub e, I guess. And you can find what the escape velocity has to be. How's that? You okay with that? Okay, so one of the reasons that we bother with this whole potential and potential energy picture is that, remember that the vectors are a pain. If I truly want to move something in from some radius far away, and I want to calculate the amount of work it takes, then I have this complicated integral that I have to use, which, remember, has for work, it's the integral of f dot ds, so it's whatever force I'm exerting on it, and then I have to dot that into whatever the ds is for the path that I take until I get to the new radius. And that's complicated. So it turns out that the energy is generally easier to deal with. I mean, we sort of did that integral and we figured out what the potential energy function is. It's that gmm over r. And now, once I know that and I have a conservative system, I can calculate the energy flow based only on those endpoints, sort of like you did with the spring, right? The energy stored in the spring only depends on this 1/2 kx², where x is the extent for the compression. So the same is true with gravitation. I can, in principle, figure out the energy in the system relatively easily. And when I have the energy and how it changes as a function of position, I can then calculate the force component along any direction just by taking the derivative of that function. So that turns out to be very powerful. We won't be doing a lot of it here, but it is going to be shoved down your throat till you gag, and then more next semester in terms of electricity, okay? And in fact, I was just noticing as I walked in here, Physics 142, which is electromagnetism for honors physics majors, is right before we walk in. And this is the potential of the electric field as a function of distance. This is just a constant. You basically get the Q over R, just like we have an M over R. And etc. This is the energy difference to the electric field coming from the difference in potential. So you can see it's coming. At any rate, so I just wanted to point out that you'll see all this again. One of the points which is sort of relevant for us though is that potential is sort of easier to deal with in a lot of ways than the force. If I ask how much work does it take to bring a particle in from far away, if I have a system where I have two masses, for example, it turns out that amount of work is the amount of work it would take to bring it in to some position relative to the first one, and bring it into the same position relative to the second one, just summed together. So the total potential and the total energy in the system is basically the energy of each of the individual parts. So if I bring it in a distance r1 from m1, then that gives me this term for the energy, and if I bring it in to this point p, at that point it has a distance r2 from m2, which gives me that term, and the total energy is just the sum of those two. So it's a scalar. You're just adding something up. It doesn't matter about the direction. If I worry about what is the gravitational field or what is the force on part, the point P, this one is attracting it to the left and this one is attracting it to the right, and you have a more complicated calculation you have to worry about. So. Okay? So that's the end of the material for exam 2. Okay. Alright. So what does momentum mean to you? The likeness of an object to continue in its given motion. All right, that's pretty good. In English, what does it mean for you? I mean, it's sort of the same thing, right? I've been hearing reports that Romney's campaign has momentum, which basically means, you know, it gives you the sense that it's going strongly and it's not going to be easily changed from its course, right? So we use that word in English very much sort of the way that it is in physics. So we have Newton's second law. And one way to write that is mdv over dt instead of ma. But it turns out that Newton's second law, as we've been using it, is actually sort of a special case. Because look at what happens if I imagine having the mass inside the derivative. So this is equal to the derivative of mv with respect to time. Well, okay, let me start out with that. And then remember the rule for how you take derivatives of a product. If we assume that m is a constant, then you get what we're used to seeing. You can pull m out. But suppose you have a system where m may change, and you think, what are you talking about? Rockets. Right, most of the mass of a rocket is in its fuel. And as it spews its fuel out the back, and so that it goes forward, its mass changes. And you have to take that mass change into account if you want to understand how rockets move. You think of conveyor belts, right, where you're dumping crushed rock on it as it goes in some industrial thing, right? The mass is changing as a function of time. So it is not true that the mass is always constant. So you can imagine having mdv over dt plus dm over dt times v. So you get this additional term that you have to worry about if the mass is changing. So that said, we're going to assume that's always zero for this class, okay? So you might ask me, then why are we talking about this? Well, I really want to take this form, dmv over dt, And since we now realize that you really can't just pull the M out without making an assumption, such as, and come up with what we're used to seeing here, unless you make an assumption about the mass, this actually is a more fundamental form than what you're used to. So we're going to define this combination of MV as a new vector, which we'll call momentum. And if you look at this, I think you'll see that it really has all the characteristics that you might expect it to have if you think about using the word momentum if you're a football player, for example. If you have a massive person running very fast, they have a very big momentum, right? Actually, I want to come back to that analogy because I want to take it a little bit further, and then we can make that make a lot more sense. So this thing is a vector. So that means that P is equal to MV tells you that P in the X is equal to MV in the X, P in the Y is equal to MV in the Y, and P in the Z is equal to MV in the Z, right? It's a vector, so you've got all three components you have to fret about. And the more fundamental form of Newton's second law, then, is that the force is equal to dP over dt. So to make a big change in momentum, I have to exert a large force, is the way to think about it. And now you can think a moment about this football analogy. If I have some big linebacker running at me really, really hard, I'm going to have a very hard time exerting a force large enough to make any difference in his motion or change his momentum. Okay? If it's a scrawny little guy, then I can probably exert a force that will change his momentum. Okay? If they're really heavy guy, it matters. If they're moving really fast, it matters. So it's this combination of the two that sort of are important. So the differential change in momentum is equal to the force exerted over a differential time. It's a vector thing. I can integrate both sides and get basically the change in the momentum, and it's a vector, so that would be P at the end or at point 2 minus P at point 1, vector difference, and that will be equal to the integral from the initial time to the final time of the force times dt. This piece is defined as impulse. So this may be really hard to calculate. Typically it is if it's over a short period of time. So like a baseball bat hitting a baseball happens over a really short time, but you get a massive change in momentum. The baseball is coming 100 kilometers per hour this way, and all of a sudden it's flying off at some speed greater than that the other way, right? So it's a huge change both in its velocity, not its mass, but in the velocity piece changes. So this is known as the impulse. You may occasionally see a problem that involves the impulse, but not too often. but I want to use it to get to something that that we will use a lot. So let's suppose that I have two masses, say M1 and M2, that are flying toward each other, say with V1 or V2, and they collide. So you can imagine these are billiard balls if you want. And so when they collide, they move apart. And a way to think about it is they move apart because M2 exerts a force on M1, and M1 exerts a force on M2. This happens over a certain amount of time, so they each exert an impulse on the other, if you will. And that means each of them has a change in their momentum, which is why they change in their direction. So let's look at that for a moment. The change in the momentum for mass 1 is equal to the integral during the collision from the initial time to the final time of the force of 2 on 1 over dt. Okay? And if we look at the change in the momentum of the second mass, that goes from the initial time to the final time, which are the same because the collision is the same time for each, times the integral of the force of 1 on 2, because we're talking about the impulse now on mass 2, over the same amount of time. But because of Newton's third law, we know that the force of 2 on 1 is equal to minus the force of 1 on 2, right? It's the same magnitude in opposite direction at all time, instantaneously. It has to be because of Newton's third law. At any given moment, if I froze time, one mass would be exerting a force on the other, and because of Newton's third law, the other would be exerting a force which is exactly opposite in direction, same in magnitude as the first one. So this means that delta P1 is equal to minus delta P2. Or delta P1 plus delta P2 is equal to zero. The change in the momentum of the first one plus the change in the momentum of the second one is zero. Okay? So that's a statement that if you take a system and you have no external things dealing with it, and you sum all the momentum changes over some period of time, you get a constant. Right? It doesn't change overall. So the sum of the changes in momentum vectorially is equal to zero. So this is a statement of what we call momentum conservation. Using the red because it's really important. It constrains. Actually, let me say it in a different way. Explicitly, there are no external forces acting on a system. The total momentum of the system is conserved. It does not change. So if you take the momentum of the vector momentum of all the stuff you have initially, it will be equal to the sum of the vector momentum that you have at the end. And this is very powerful because it effectively gives you three equations that constrain every system, because it's true along each of the three orthogonal directions, x, y, and z. Okay? And it is always true. Note that we talked a lot about energy conservation earlier, and I always said it is always true, but it is not always useful for you. Okay? Momentum conservation is always true. And if you have the information that you can use to calculate momentum, it's always true. You don't have to worry about whether you have friction in the problem or something like that. Well, okay, is that a lie? No, that's not a lie. Those of you who think this may not affect your life, this is not important to you. I'm going to tell you a story. Because, in fact, momentum conservation was used to predict the existence of the neutrino. It was. So you say, well, what is a neutrino? Well, there was a time before people thought there were such a thing. There was such a thing, or whatever. Okay, so you imagine that if you have some sort of radioactive crud, one type might be potassium-40, which has 19 protons, and it will decay into calcium-40, and when it does, it will emit an electron, okay? Ooh. And so beta decay is actually a very common sort of thing. You may run into it around the hospital, or you may run into radioactive substances that you use in the laboratory very often. So it's not like it's something that you don't run into a lot of the time. It was known, for example, that when you have beta decay happening, a species like potassium turns into calcium. And note that calcium has an atomic number, the number of protons that are in calcium, is greater than that in potassium by one. So, and to conserve charge, you kick out a minus charge, which is the electron, which you can actually detect. Okay, so this whole thing is known as beta decay. And what is thought happens is that inside the nucleus, you have a neutron that decays into a proton plus an electron. Okay, so pretty simple. So this you would actually have to have just to account for what you already know, which is you have this change in species and you have an electron coming out. So it makes sense. And if this happens, you then have certain expectations. What you would expect to see if you're sitting still where the neutron is, then the neutron literally decays into a proton and an electron. And for a two-body decay, basically they have to come out back to back because of momentum conservation. If the proton, for example, had a component of velocity at some weird angle, the electron has to have a component of velocity in order for its momentum in that other direction to cancel. So if you have a two-body decay like this, they have to come off back-to-back due to momentum conservation. So we know that from momentum conservation that the mass of the electron times the velocity of the electron must equal minus the mass of the proton times the velocity of the proton. Because the total is zero. Right? We start out with zero momentum because the neutrons with rest. And so this momentum and that momentum have to be equal on opposite sides. So what you actually measure, if you're looking at this thing, is you have a sample, and you actually measure an electron coming out. And there are devices that you can use to actually measure the momentum of the electron and identify the electron. So what we'd like to do is, given this physical model, I'd like to ask, what does the energy of the electron look like? How fast does it come out? Because I can measure that. I can put in a little spectrophotometer and see how it moves. Okay. So the kinetic energy, the total kinetic energy in the system, which basically is a measure of how much energy do you get out of the mass difference between the neutron and the proton and changes in what happens in the nuclei. But generally we call this Q. That's equal to the kinetic energy of the electron plus the kinetic energy of the proton, which is 1/2 mass of the electron and velocity of the electron squared plus 1/2 times the mass of the proton times the velocity of the proton squared. And it turns out this Q value is a number which is known for every type of decay. We basically know how much energy is available to be shared in these particles. So if I use the momentum conservation equation, then I find that the velocity of the electron is equal to minus the mass of the proton over the mass of the electron times the velocity of the proton. And if I substitute that in for this value of Q, so I want to take, I solved for that the wrong way, sorry. The velocity of the proton is equal to minus the mass of the proton over the mass of the mass of the electron over the mass of the proton times the velocity of the electron. Because I want to substitute in for this VP, I want to get rid of the velocity of the proton. Okay. And when I do that, I'll get Q is equal to the kinetic energy of the electron times the mass of the electron over the mass of the proton plus 1. All right, so you get a very definite prediction that if I solve for the kinetic energy of the electron, which is 1/2 mv electron squared, then I get Q times the mass of the proton over the mass of the proton plus the mass of the electron. And the purpose of all this was simply to say that this is a fixed number. Okay. What it says is that if you have a two-body decay like this, that electron is going to come out with a fixed kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared. The mass of the electron is fixed, so therefore the velocity of that electron has a very particular value. Okay. And this is something you can actually go and look for. So if you go in the laboratory and you take a sample and you look at the kinetic energy of the electrons coming off and you ask, how many of them do I measure as a function of what the kinetic energy is of the electron? What our model just told us, if beta decay consists of a neutron decay into a proton and an electron back to back, then you can't get around the fact that basically you would expect to see a peak in the kinetic energy of the electron coming off and nothing else. Now, every device you use to measure the kinetic energy of the electron isn't going to be perfect. So in fact, what you would expect to see is a little bit of a smear about this peak. So you'd actually get something like that in terms of the kinetic energy of the electron experimentally. And it turns out that if you go and you do the experiment, you find something really weird. You get something that looks like that. And they don't agree at all. I mean, it's not even close. And the experiment's easy to do, and it's sort of like what's broken. So in the 1920s, this was a massive puzzle. And in 1930-31, a guy named Wolfgang Pauli hypothesized a solution to this. And his hypothesis was that the neutron does not just go into a proton and electron, but that the neutron decays into a proton and an electron and some other particle. And this other particle is what we call a neutrino. And what he said was, all right, we don't see the neutrino, but if we allow this decay to happen into three bodies instead of two bodies, then you lose that constraint and it allows this energy spectrum to get smeared out. And so he says that apparently in beta decay, you get the emission of some other particle that we can't detect very easily. So it passes right through us. Okay? And this was the birth of the neutrino. And it took about 20 years, a little bit more, almost 30 years. In 1959, a guy named Rhinus and collaborators went outside of a nuclear reactor in Savannah, South Carolina, Savannah River. And they put a big detector that was actually capable of identifying where they were actually able to see a few neutrinos. Because what happens in the nuclear reactions in a nuclear reactor, you have lots of neutrinos emitted. But it turns out neutrinos really can pass through most material. If I have a neutrino and I shoot it, it can go through something like 70 light years of lead or water without interacting. And so they're very, very seldom interacting. So the only way to see them is to have a huge detector and lots of neutrinos. Okay? But this is an example of where momentum conservation was used to discover something very fundamental about the universe, which is the existence of this strange sort of particle that we have no evidence existed in any other form. So if you didn't think it was really important to you, now you do. Okay. Any thoughts? No? Okay. So let me do a momentum conservation problem. Well, let me do this first. Let's wake up. Two carts. Okay? And you will witness that in fact, got that? They have about the same mass. Now we shall take said carts and put them on a device where we can remove the curse of friction from our lives. We have elastic bumpers death are to a close approximation frictionless when we have a collision. So you're not really losing energy. What do you think will happen if I take this part and make it go that way and hit that part? They have the same mass. This one will be moving with some mass times velocity, okay? And when it hits here, that's the quantity that gets conserved, okay? Is it working? Now I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm going to add mass to this one. No. I'm going to add mass to this one because it's got a place to take it. So I'm going to pretty close to double its mass. Alright? And now, let's see what happens. This one now has twice the mass or so. Right, so when it hits, I have to conserve momentum. So that one takes off going fast. This one still moves, though. So if I take this one and I hit that one, now this moves. This one has to go backward to give that one enough energy to go. So in the end, in each of these collisions, you're just conserving momentum. So there are two types of collisions we're going to consider. One is the type that we're looking at here, or the type that you would know about if you played billiards. And those collisions are called elastic collisions. And in elastic collisions, you conserve energy, kinetic energy. You always conserve energy, but it's not always useful. In an elastic collision, you more or less, you do, by definition, conserve energy. So for example, in this case, it's sort of easy to see. They have the same mass. This one's moving at a certain velocity. The other one pretty much moves away at exactly that same velocity, so they have the same mass. So you have conservation of the kinetic energy here. If I had that one equipped with a little bit of C4, so that when the other one hit it, it exploded, okay, then we would not be conserving kinetic energy. So in a situation where you have something where friction is involved or an explosive is involved or something like that, momentum conservation actually still holds, but energy conservation is no longer useful for you. Energy conservation does hold, but not in a way that's useful for you. In those types of collisions, so if I put a clay billiards ball on the table, so when somebody shoots and breaks, they hit the ball, it actually shatters, okay? That would be what we call an inelastic collision. And in inelastic collisions, kinetic energy conservation is not a useful quantity. So there'll be certain types of problems you'll see where the kinetic energy is not conserved. And if you pull out kinetic energy conservation, you're wrong. Okay? So you have to always think about what's going on in the type of collision that you have. So I'll do a couple of examples. The first example that I want to do is one which involves elastic collisions. So let's suppose you're looking from above down on a hockey rink, and we have a hockey puck 1 that's moving at 0.3 meters per second, and hockey puck 2 is starting with an initial velocity of 0. And then what happens with time is that hockey puck 1 goes and hits 2, and glances off, and 2 goes off that way. Okay, so that's the type of collision that we have. And so you could argue that this is, or you, let's say that this is the initial state, the black, which I've drawn. And the final state will consist of hockey puck 1 moving off with some V1 final in a direction which has theta 1 equal to 30 degrees with, we'll say this is the y direction, this is the x direction, so it'll be 30 degrees with the x axis. And hockey puck 2 will move off with some angle theta 2 and with some velocity V2F. So I have the initial conditions specified. I've given you the conditions finally for the second one. I think that I want to say that the second velocity V1F, which isn't written very well, is equal to 0.26 meters per second. So what you'd like to do with this problem is find V2F magnitude and theta 2. Okay, so that's the actual problem. So we know that momentum is conserved. Okay? Momentum conserved says that P initial vector is equal to P final vector. It is a vector. So that means momentum is conserved in the x and in the y. So this becomes two equations. P initial in the x is equal to P initial in the y. And P initial in the x is equal to P final in the x. And P initial in the y is equal to P final in the y. And I've now dropped the vector arrows because I've got them in one-dimensional thing. And remember, in one dimension, that's, you still have to deal with the algebraic sign in order to determine direction. Right? That's how you do it. So it uses a lot of the same tricks that you're used to. And I guess I'll put sums here, so it's the sum over all the various momenta. Okay. So let's look at the x equation. So the initial for 1 is going to be mv here. For 2, the initial momentum is 0. For final, note that we have this sort of jump. We have to actually look at the components here. So we have to break these velocities up into x and y components in order to determine what the momentum components are. So this piece is V1F times the cosine of theta 1 is going to be equal to the momentum of mass 1 in the final in the x. This piece is V1F times the sine of theta 1 is equal to the momentum of mass 1 in the final state in the y. Okay? Similarly, we'll have that V2F times the sine of theta 2 is equal to, it's minus, okay, let me be more explicit. This component is going in the minus y direction, so I put in a minus sign, and it's minus V2F times the sine of theta 2, and that is going to be the momentum of mass 2 in the final state in the y direction. Similarly, we will have another component here, which will be the x component for mass 2, but it will be going in the positive x direction, so I don't need to flip the sign. So if I just look at the x equation, then I have that P P1x PIx plus PIy. Oh boy, too many masses and things. Sorry. So I have the momentum of mass 1 in the x initial, plus the momentum of mass 2 in the x initial, which is 0 because it's just sitting there. So is equal to, geez, the momentum of mass 1 in the x final plus the momentum of mass 2 in the x final. So momentum of mass 1 is going to be the mass of mass 1 times its initial velocity, which you've been given. The second term is 0. And that's equal to the sum of the two x velocities of momenta. So we have the P1F in the x, which is this. Plus the similar thing for the second mass. All right, so that's the x equation. In the y, in the initial state, this mass is moving this way, this mass isn't moving at all. There's no velocity component at all in the y. So the initial state has a momentum of 0. So for the y equation, we have 0 is equal to the sum of the final state momenta in the y, which will be the sum of this piece times the sum of that piece. Oh, and I made a mistake here. All of these need to be multiplied by the mass if they're going to be momenta over here. So sorry about that. So this will be M1. This will be M1. This will be M2. And this will have an M2. Otherwise, they're not momenta. Similarly, down here, I have to have the M1. note that because the mass hasn't changed, that that will just cancel out. So for the y equation, I have to sum this piece and that piece, and this one comes in with the opposite sign because it's going in the opposite direction. So I have m1 v1 f sine theta 1 minus m2 v2 f sine theta 2. And notice that I blew this particular mass right here, has to be m2, so they don't actually cancel as cleanly as I was about to say they did. Okay, because this is momentum of 2 in the x direction. So now we have another equation. So you get the feeling this is sort of tedious. Sorry, it's the way it is. So now we have two equations. I've been given all of the information here. I've been given this angle 1. I've been given this velocity. So I've been given the... assume I'm given the masses. Let's see if I wrote this wrong. So I now have two equations, actually, with two unknowns, where the unknowns are going to be theta 2 and V2F. So this has already bored us to tears, so I'm not going to do the algebra. But you can do the algebra. What I will tell you is that when I do this, I find that V2F, so it's two equations, two unknowns, I'm trying to look. I had numbers here. I'm looking to see if I actually wrote down the math. Okay, so I did write down the math for these numbers I'm about to give you. Assume that the m1 is equal to m2 in terms of mass, which is equal to 0.1 kilogram. So when you do the calculation, you can plug it in with that. So V2F, when I do this, is equal to 0.15 meters per second, and theta 2 is equal to 60 degrees down from the plus x axis.
What was that?
0.1 kilograms. Yeah. Okay, so as you can see, it's sort of tedious because you have to break it up into components. So it's a little bit like some projectile problem because you have to worry about the motion of each component separately. If I give this exam something just like this or very similar to this on an exam, I have to be very cautious because you can see how tedious it gets, okay? And I didn't skip any algebra, which is also tedious, okay? But the other thing is, I can tell you that when I do a huge chunk of the class, it conserves momentum in one dimension. And if you do that, you'll get one equation. You have two unknowns, and good luck. You end up wasting a lot of time, it doesn't work, okay? Momentum conservation is a vector thing, so it happens in all orthogonal dimensions separately. It's extremely powerful. You can get three equations if it's a three-dimensional problem. Okay? Where you ought to be thinking in terms of collisions and stuff is can I or can I not use kinetic energy conservation? There, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But for momentum conservation, yes, you always, always, always can use it. And you can use it in each dimension separately. And in fact, you have to. Yes?
Is it by coincidence that the two angles added up to that degree?
Probably not.
I mean, that's not something that's applicable in more settings than just this.
That statement is absolutely true.
Right.
It probably is an accident of my having the masses be the same, I would guess. But no, there's no constraint that those angles have to add up to 90 degrees. let's do another one where, let's say that we have a gun that shoots a bullet, and we have a block of wood and this block of wood is basically hanging from strings. So we have V of a bullet, and then we have V of a block of wood plus a bullet. So basically I'm going to assume that the bullet gets embedded into the wood. Statement of kinetic energy conservation. It says that the initial kinetic, this is just sitting here, I have an initial kinetic energy. This bullet then becomes embedded in the block, and the bullet and block now move with some velocity this way. It's hanging by string, so it'll actually go up, and so we'll use a measurement of height to get the energy. But you then would have a kinetic energy in this final state of the mass of the bullet plus the mass of the block times the velocity of this combination squared. You okay with that? Can I use it? Lots of you will when I get it on the test, but you should. Why? The bullet sort of has to fight its way into the block. I don't know doodly squat about bullets fighting their way into the block, but I can imagine that you got to rip a lot of cellulose off and things get nasty, use a lot of friction and stuff. I don't know what to do with that. So energy is conserved, yes, but not in a way that's useful for me. Okay? So this would be what we would call an inelastic collision, because you know you've lost some energy to some other stuff. Because of that, this equation is not useful for you, okay? But momentum conservation is useful. Okay. So the statement of momentum conservation is the mass of the bullet times the velocity of the bullet is equal to the mass of the bullet plus the mass of the block times the velocity of the bullet-block combination. And I only need the one dimension because that collision is only happening in one dimension. You say, yeah, but this thing's hanging from a string. That block doesn't move by the time that collision's over. The block, you can sort of imagine the bullet happening gets embedded and the block begins to move then. So you don't have to consider that dimension for the momentum conservation. So I'm out of time. We're going to come back and solve this problem Thursday. You can look forward to that.